Thank you all for returning promptly from recess. We have the next opportunity here, this next item on the agenda today is an opportunity for public comment on Northern Spotted Owl rulemaking. And we have three individuals signed up. Arthur West. Please remember the three-minute rule.
Thank you for getting along with me to speak. I don't know where to begin on this. I guess I can begin by saying this work group represents an abuse of the judicial process. When you go to court, it's supposed to be an efficient process. You go to court, present evidence, the judge rules, you follow the ruling. I don't think it's appropriate to go to court, then destroy the evidence, as was happened in this case, and then enter into some form of agreement that allows for nothing to be done for years. So I think this represents an abuse of the judicial process. I think it also represents $250,000 of public money wasted. And now this results from a suspension of the moratorium on personal service contracts, $250,000 that was spent for a private person in this case, in this task force or group. I don't think that was appropriate. I think that this new paradigm that they're trying to evolve is gobbledygook. It's not based on science. Now, if you know about paradigms and you've read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Kuhn, where the term was pretty much invented, paradigms result from a problem with an existing scientific structure. They're based on empirical data. They're based on science. It's a scientific term. There is no science in this. This is a new paradigm that removes the stick from the carrot and stick form of regulation and control that we've had and worked with, well with for many years. And I don't think it's appropriate to do, especially since there's no empirical evidence that the old procedure wasn't working, and because it's been done largely behind closed doors with an illegal expenditure of almost $250,000 of public money on a private consultant to do the public's business. Totally inappropriate, and the entire methodology of this group is inappropriate. It represents a failure process, and as people have said, the owls are dying. Nothing's been done to solve the problem, and it's because of this breakdown in process and this bureaucratic logjam. Now, I would hope that you can adopt today some interim measures to actually protect the owl, and then have everybody go back to court, maybe, and get a solution or do something to break this logjam, because having the people with competing interests sit down and pretend like they don't have competing interests isn't going to work. It's sort of like Gabriel and Lucifer getting together to try to bureaucratically decide what type of wallpaper they're going to have in purgatory. It's a useless exercise. It's not going to produce any reasonable regulatory scheme, no matter how long it goes. You cannot, if I suppose some people have had experience training dogs, you can't train a dog with merely positive incentives. You try to use positive incentives to make sure your dog won't create a mess in the house, it's not going to work. The same thing is going to happen with spotted owls. As we said, spotted owls, the habitat continues to decline. We can talk about barred owls. Well, yes, barred owls might have a problem, but the real problem is they're cutting down the trees in the habitat. Okay, and that hasn't been addressed. So this whole exercise is a waste of public time. It's a waste of government time. We have very little resources. Why are we spending money on a board that hasn't, or a group that hasn't, fulfilled its mandate, and
Mr. West,
okay.
It's 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next person who signed up is Rick Dunning. Rick, are you here? I think you have a proxy. Rick has a proxy.
Thank you. I was asked to read this for Rick Dunning, who is executive director of the Washington Farm Forestry Association. He says, WFFA, in its effort of collaboration, he puts a little smile there, I thought you'd like that, supports the dedicated efforts and the recommendations of the Northern Spotted Owl Committee and their 10 points 1 through 7. Rick Dunning.
All right. Awards to your standing in for Rick. That was well done. Short and sweet. That's how we like them. Tim McBride.
Commissioner, members of the board, Tim McBride with Hancock Forest Management. I also play a role as the Forest Policy Committee Chairman for WFPA. I'd just like to follow up on the conversation that you and I had, Commissioner, out in the hall at lunchtime, and let the rest of the board kind of aware of some new information on spotted owls, what the scientists have been learning on spotted owls and the barred owl interaction issue, and then suggest to the board that back in 2005, I think we had a two-day workshop on spotted owls and the spotted owl habitat issue and things like that. But I think to build on that and for all of you to get a good understanding of where the science has come since then, is you should send out a request or an invitation to Jim Thrailkill with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and ask him to come and present the new information that they've been discovering through their analyses on the different demographic areas across the spotted owl range, and looking at the 15 years worth of data that a lot of us have contributed to through the demographic surveying efforts that have been going on. And they have, over the last 6 months, analyzed the impacts of barred owls on spotted owl response in many of these areas. And this analysis has been conducted by reputable scientists at Oregon State University, at the Weyerhaeuser Company. Our own Hancock Forest Management has contracted the services of Dale Herder with Radke Associates to attend these meetings. And I think there's just a wealth of information out there that really needs to be brought to the table. And it's unfortunate that members of many of these caucuses, the state, the Audubon's, they've been part of this group, this barred owl working group, and yet they failed to mention that this analysis has been complete, and it would be very timely and very informative to your discussions here. So, again, Jim Thrailkill, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would have some really good information for you all for this discussion. So, thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you, Tim. All right, that concludes our public comment on Northern Spotted Owl rulemaking. On with the issue at hand then, I'd ask Darren to come forward. And what we have for consideration is pilot rulemaking for Northern Spotted Owl. I've asked Darren to sort of give the staff's recommendation to this board, given the complexity of the issue, given the importance of the issue before the board. I hope it will be helpful to have him spell out what he sees as a path forward through this process.
Thank you, Commissioner, members of the board. Here, Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. As Commissioner stated, you have two items on your agenda that actually come out of the consensus recommendations in the report. But to step back a little bit and take a look at the kind of menu of options you have in front of you, you certainly have the consensus recommendations that are in the report that the work group members spoke of this morning, and you also have three sets of non-consensus recommendations, one from the Conservation Caucus, one from the Industry, and one from the Government Caucus. So you certainly can accept the consensus recommendations, but what to do with the others, I think, is the main question. So I'm going to lay out what what we have is a staff recommendation for you, and then we can answer questions, or I or others on the work group can answer questions, and then we'll move on to the agenda topics that come from the consensus recommendations. So our staff recommendation is that you accept the consensus recommendations from the working group, and that you convene an implementation team to oversee implementation of those recommendations. Certainly, there's lots of little details that need to be worked out about how those recommendations would get implemented. And we see a small team of folks, probably five individuals, one from DNR as the chair of that group, one from DFW, one from industry, one from conservation, and one from a land trust or eco-trust type organization. That group would report back to you in May, hopefully, on an implementation plan for how to deal with the consensus recommendations. And they would also determine if they would need facilitation to accomplish that task. So that's how we think you should handle the consensus recommendations. As I mentioned earlier, there are two items on the agenda that are consensus recommendations that you're being asked to consider and potentially take action on today. As far as the other non-consensus recommendations that you heard about from the work group members this morning, we would recommend that the implementation team be tasked with enhancing the interaction with the feds on their work with the Bardell and Bardell control experiments, making sure that we're tied in closely with that effort and understanding what's going on and how we can benefit from it, not try to duplicate that effort. We'd also recommend that you task the implementation team with convening a technical group to answer specific questions about the spatial temporal strategic contribution to recovery that the state should make. And that technical group certainly could report directly to the board, but we would suggest that the implementation team convene that group and oversee their work. So that's the staff recommendation for how you should move forward with the Spotted Owl Working Group effort.
So then, if you could for us, and thank you for that recommendation, if you could for us, please spell out how this pilot rulemaking folds into that that recommendation.
So the first item from the consensus recommendations.
I was going to ask if you could repeat the last one because I didn't get that.
Of course,
if that would be possible.
Last item is for the implementation team to convene a technical group to answer specific questions about the spatial and temporal strategic contributions to the OWL recovery that the state should make.
Thank you.
Darren, what do you see being on that technical team?
I would leave that up to the implementation team to determine the best mix of technical individuals.
Okay, please proceed with the next issue.
So one of the items from the consensus recommendation is a pilot rule that you have in your packet. You have the pre-proposal statement of inquiry CR101 and then an appendix to that that describes in more detail what the pilot rule is intended to accomplish. This is also on page 11 of the working group's report. The purpose of the proposed pilot rule is to explore the potential to improve or create habitat for northern spotted owl in four stands on the east side, particularly NTS SOCI, that have high stand densities. So as a look at thinning to see if habitat can be improved or created, there are operational, economic, and rule-based explorations that would occur as part of this pilot. The project planning area comprises about 1,200 acres in the NTS SOCI. Thinning operations would occur on up to 640 acres conducted with one FPA. The pilot rule would allow this to proceed as a Class 3 rather than a Class 4 special. I've asked the folks from the working group that are working on this effort to provide an initial report to you once they have worked out all the details for how this would get implemented on the ground, and then follow-up reports as the pilot is implemented throughout its life. So that's a brief summary of the pilot rule. You have the CR101, and if you have any questions about it, I will try to answer them.
I have a question in the pilot proposal document there on the bottom of page 2. It says, if funding is available, monitoring may be conducted. Understanding that obviously funding is necessary. Seems like this all could be pretty pointless if we can't monitor what the effects are. Not much of a pilot rule if we can't learn something from it.
Right. I would agree with that. I think, not being on the group, I'm going to speculate a little bit, but I believe that the conditions listed there are taken together. It's not individually, so that if funding is needed to either implement or monitor the implementation of the pilot rule, then this needs to be in place before they would actually proceed.
That will be set up in advance.
Yes. Yes.
Darren, I think this was brought up, this pilot project was brought up, I believe, at our previous board meeting, and there were some unresolved questions apparently at that time, which is why it didn't proceed into rulemaking then. Are those questions answered to the satisfaction of staff and the team?
Well, if I'm being honest, I would still say I would prefer to see a full plan in place before we implement the rule. However, my main concern was that we didn't have enough information to adequately notify the public of your actions with regard to the pilot rule. I think this Appendix A does that.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? This is just one of, what, 9 recommendations, or is it more than?
This is one. There's one recommendation that deals with 2 pilot projects.
And I'll remind the board this was consensus from the process. Opposed actions, questions?
Sure. Would you like, if there's a general recommendation to move forward with accepting the consensus recommendation, convene a, have the implementation team convene a technical team. That's not the pilot program. Would you like a motion?
Well, I think, I think I'd like a motion on the pilot project itself.
In anticipation, we have a draft motion ready for your viewing pleasure, should you want to look at it.
For the pilot.
That would be appropriate if you could. Right, I believe so. Want to read that for us, please, Darren?
Move that the Forest Practices Board approve the Northern Spotted Owl Habitat Conservation Pilot Rulemaking and direct staff to file the CR 101 pre-notice of inquiry with the Office of Code Revisor to inform the public of the pilot. The pilot will explore whether thinning and overstock stands to improve spotted owl habitat quality is operationally and economically feasible. Forest practices conducted under this pilot will vary from existing forest practices rules, and the board determines that the pilot rule is in the public interest and necessary to conduct the exploration. Forest practices will be processed and conducted in accordance with the CR 101.
And Darren, this motion only applies to the logging pilot piece, correct?
That's correct.
Because aren't we going to be taking some action on a Rainier piece?
No. We don't have a pilot rule for that project. I don't think a pilot rule is necessary to accomplish the intent of that project.
Very good.
Nora, I move that the pilot will proceed as is presented to us.
Second.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion properly supported to adopt this spotted owl pilot rule. Discussion on the motion. Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. Opposed? Thank you. Let the record show the that carried unanimously.
Thank you. If you want to move on to the next agenda topic, I'll ask Gretchen to come up, or we can continue question or discussion on the staff recommendation on how to deal with the work group report.
What I would suggest is perhaps that we continue on with the next rulemaking, and then we can have further discussion for your other recommendations. Does that meet with board approval? Okay, let's continue. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good afternoon to all of you.
I'm Gretchen Robinson, and today I'm here to request for your approval to continue with the Northern Spotted Owl rulemaking that you've been working on for the last over a year. So this would involve a permanent rule and an emergency rule. For a bit of background, the Spotted Owl Policy Working Group, in its November 10, 2009 report, recommended, and I quote, that the current decertification process continue under an open-ended rule with an annual review until the revised federal Spotted Owl survey protocols are released and the board resolves outstanding questions regarding this issue, end quote. And at the November 10th meeting, the board directed staff to amend the rule language accordingly for the board's consideration today at this meeting. According to the Administrative Procedure Act, if an agency wants to adopt a rule that is substantially different from the rule that was distributed initially for public review, the agency must file a supplemental notice and hold at least one additional hearing. So now you have before you, in your board packet, revised language and a revised preliminary economic analysis. The language now does not include an end date for the existence of the three-person Spotted Owl Advisory Conservation Advisory Group. And the language now does include the board's annual review of the need for the advisory group's function, as was recommended by the Policy Working Group. The economic analysis is revised, as I explained in my memorandum in your board materials. So today I'm asking for possibly two board actions, and the first would be to direct staff to file a supplemental CR 102 with the code revisor. This will provide the public with the revised language and the revised economic analysis, and inform the public that the board is reinitiating permanent rulemaking and will hold an additional hearing. So that's that part. So if you did approve staff going through with that, then we'd go on to the emergency rule.
So just please remind the board and its chair what the purpose of this rule is.
The purpose is to continue the decertification, Northern Spotted Owl decertification process, as has been in emergency rule for the last 1+ years. So to continue that on. And a permanent rulemaking, if you approve today this action for the supplemental CR 102 permanent rulemaking, you could adopt the permanent rule in May.
Okay. So you understand what we're doing here. All right. So let's just take this issue, please. What does the board wish to do with this proposal?
Do we have a motion?
We could display a motion if you like. Yes.
It's how thoughtful of you.
Anticipating our every need.
So
like.
would you like me to read it?
Please.
Okay. So the board could move that the Forest Practices Board approve the draft rule proposal amending WACs 2221-6010 and 2221-6080. For public review and direct staff to file a supplemental CR 102 proposed rulemaking, that's the form, the name of the form, to initiate permanent rulemaking. The rule proposal removes language about the moratorium on Northern Spotted Owl decertification, adds a definition of Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group, and adds language in critical habitats, which specifies the group's function.
All right. Does the board understand? Do we need any further explanation of the purpose of this rule?
I'm not sure I'm quite understanding.
The critical habitats, perhaps.
Adds language in critical habitats.
Well, that
the
is the section.
Habitats.
16080 is the critical habitats section.
Oh, and section.
Yes. Yeah. Of the rules. So above it says 222-16080, and that is the critical habitat section.
Right.
Is that clear?
Commissioner, I just had a question, actually. It's probably for you, Gretchen. So the language in 0010 about the Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group. The last sentence there is saying that the board is going to review on an annual basis whether the group's function continues to be needed for conservation of the owl. So if the board were to decide 1 year that group is no longer needed, does that just mean that the new part of 080 that involves the group, Section H, would that just go away?
We probably do rulemaking to make it go away, yes.
Okay. Just checking.
Any other questions? The motion would be appropriate.
Approval. Second.
Okay, we have a motion properly supported to adopt this rule. Discussion on the motion. Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. Thank you. Again, let the record show it's unanimous. Thank you very much. And thank you, Gretchen, for that presentation of those two rules. So then I think the question goes back to you, Darren, about the remainder of the staff recommendation. Do you have one
there
more?
There is one more because the existing emergency rule won't last until May. So I would request that the board approve new emergency rule language that is the same as the permanent rule language that you just approved us going forward with.
Because that won't go into effect until May, and you're trying to cover this interim?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
It's okay, and we also have a motion available for you for that, if you like.
Imagine that. Okay.
So it would be that a board member moves that the Forest Practices Board adopts the emergency rule that amends WACS 222-16010, 222-16080, and direct staff to file a CR 103E rulemaking order to be effective upon filing.
So moved.
A second.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion now properly supported to adopt this emergency rule to fill in this little time gap.
That's right.
Discussion on the motion? I think it's fairly straightforward what we're doing here. All those in favor, raise your hand. Okay, thank you. Opposed? No one's opposed. Let the record show that again is unanimous. Thank you very much and sorry for the oversight.
You're welcome.
So, Darren, please continue your conversation with the board about the balance of your recommendations.
I did conclude my recommendations. Basically, it's three. Accept the consensus recommendations. A sub recommendation to that is to form this implementation team, a five-member implementation team that would oversee implementation, report back to you about just how the recommendations will get implemented, and as well as to determine if they're going to need facilitation to accomplish it. Direct that implementation team to enhance our interaction with the federal services on the Barnell control experiments that they are conducting, and have that implementation team oversee the convening of a technical group to answer specific questions about the spatial and temporal strategic contribution to recovery that the state can make. So it's really three.
All right, so I hope you understand that staff recommendations were filled to some extent. I think the work groups hope that it could continue in some form, but with a definite purpose. So it's not just idling along, but it's got a definite purpose in mind. And that purpose is to implement the recommendations and to add on this one other function, which is to make sure that the best available science is being integrated into the path forward.
Right. The comment that was made by the board, the panel here, was that deadlines are a good barometer or sideboard. This is kind of open-ended. Is it not?
I think Darren had a time limit on it.
The time limit I placed on it is report back
reporting
to
back
May,
to May, but then is not the recommendation then to convene the implementation team to convene the technical team?
Right.
So that's kind of an add-on,
right.
And so is it?
Well,
can you explain to me
your
view of the time frame?
The implementation team with developing a schedule, and that
okay.
will be included in the report back to you in May.
Okay. I think I'd like to be specific about that so that we do have some time frames.
Other questions, comment?
I guess along those lines, would the implementation team be developing a work plan to get the tasks done? And I'm just a little concerned that the panel covered a lot of ground when we start talking about ecosystem services and things which I think are good topics. I'm a little concerned it could get really broad. So I guess I was going to just ask a question of the work plan. Exactly over this time that the implementation team would be addressing.
I'm going to ask you to, I'm unclear on what your question is, so I'm going to ask you to repeat it.
I guess maybe this isn't a real clear to me what the team would be addressing when we talked about the recommendations. But again, there was a lot of, I heard a bunch of times that particular term of ecosystem services and bringing incentives, etc. So, were all those part of that?
To the extent that they are included in the consensus recommendations, I would say yes. Obviously, I share your concern that the recommendations are broad, and that's why I think a small team that is focused on this has the best chance for success. If we don't dedicate someone to it, nothing will get done. So that's the flip side of that. The task is large, the scope potentially broad, so I think you would need to be clear with that implementation team as to priority for proceeding with the recommendations, et cetera.
Letting?
Yeah, I might add that you could have the implementation come back to you not only with a schedule, but with a fully fleshed out work plan.
Right. Right.
To give certainty that all of the areas that were represented in the consensus recommendations will be timely addressed.
And that would have prioritizations and all
yes.
of that.
Dorn? We had a really good discussion before lunch. Very thorough of the recommendations, as well as a lot of discussion, which really focused more on the areas of disagreement than on agreement. So I would hope that this implementation team can really focus on those areas of agreement within the consensus report, that they really spend their time on that, on finding ways in which those can be implemented, because those are in agreement by all the participants. And it seems like if that is the case, that is the place where we have the greatest potential to really do some good. So I would just give that as a guideline from this board that their focus be on those areas of consensus and how to fully implement them so that effort and that momentum is not lost by this report going on the shelf and this all going back to focusing on the disagreements once again, as is unfortunately too common. I appreciate the staff recommendation to immediately move this into an implementation effort so that momentum is not lost and that we do begin to make that focus. And one of those items certainly is the issue of barred owl, and certainly that's a consensus area and one that can be focused on. As far as that group convening a technical group to review, and I'm going from my notes here, may not have this quite right, spatial and technical relationships. That was not a consensus item. It was certainly one of a lot of discussion. I think maybe this implementation team, if it is put together, could spend some time trying to focus on some of the some of that spatial technical information or other information that would be helpful to continue to inform this board, and that they could come back hopefully with a consensus recommendation on that this small group of five or whatever it is may be able to spend some some time on that, and again, to come back to us with a consensus of what additional information would be helpful. The recommendation that Mr. McBride made might be a good start there, and I'm sure that there are some others as well.
Yeah, I think the purpose, if I can interpolate here a little bit, is to not have the science, not have the technical information flowing from one group or another, but to represent something that is more broadly based and is informs both the implementation group, but also eventually this board, as to what the science shows are the best strategies. So I think that's part of the goal here.
I'm not sure I follow how that's different than what I said, but
I think it's almost exactly the same.
Okay. Okay.
Did you have a point there?
I did, but I think Carolyn was.
I was just going to say the way it's been formulated is I like the package that has the technical group to do the spatial temporal contribution. Gathering of those data and reports and so forth, and sort of organizing them so that we truly are working from a best available science that's current, up to date. Not, you know, I don't know where all those things will come from. Certainly, I thought Mr. McBride's comments were relevant to the issue. But for me, you know, if we do get this into a motion piece, that's an important component of what the implementation group would be doing. I do have a question, sort of a more legalistic one, and that is, but I'm not looking at you, Phil, and that is that, so this isn't, is this a committee of the Forest Practice Board? It doesn't have Forest Practice Board members on it necessarily, I guess it could, but, so I'm wondering about how the public knows about the work of this implementation committee.
This would be just as we've managed the Spotted Owl Working Group that is concluding today.
Okay.
It would be every meeting open to the public, all materials available to the public, and we'd fully follow the Administrative Procedures Act requirements for announcing all the group's meetings, just as we've done in the past.
Good.
So it'd be completely transparent and open by law to public participation.
Okay. That's all.
Other questions?
Just briefly, to follow up on Carolyn's point, I just wanted to be clear also on, since the forming of a technical group wasn't one of the consensus recommendations, just want to be clear that that would be one of the tasks of that group, the implementation team.
It's really within the staff recommendation, that's the only non-consensus element, but it is our recommendation that we convene this technical team to provide information both for the implementation team and for the board on how we might allocate our conservation effort as we move into the future.
So, Tom?
I was just going to say, this all sounds very reasonable to me. It seems like a good step forward. I'm not sure how to put it into a motion because there's just a whole lot of different pieces here. I don't know if we should try to get it up on the screen and list the things. I know it's in your head, Darren, but that kind of scares me.
Great, me too. Unfortunately, we don't have this one drafted yet. But we could.
Well, I thought maybe we could just do it right now, live.
We could do that, or we could take a short break while we
just lay out these elements.
Put it up.
Well, the first part.
Patricia, are you in a position to be able to do this in real time?
Yes. Sher is going to be doing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
She is, but.
What's the board's wish?
Do you
want to take a short break and have them assemble? I know Darren has it written down. Or would you just like to sit here and do it in real time? What's your wishes?
I don't think it's that tough. Can I try it?
Oh, here we go.
Oh, I move. That the board accept the consensus recommendations of the Spotted Owl Working Group, and that we direct DNR to convene an implementation team.
Implementation Working Group?
Working Group. Team or Working Group?
Implementation Working Group.
Yes. Consisting of 5 members.
Should we not define those members?
Yeah, we need to.
Yeah, I'm waiting for her to catch up.
Oh, okay.
be Slavic.
Representing Department of Natural Resources, Department of Fish and Wildlife, industry, conservation groups, caucus, and the Land Trust or Good Trust.
And the last one, excuse me, Land Trust Group?
Equal.
A Land Trust Group.
Like, yeah, that's probably good enough. And we direct the implementation team to come back to the board with a work plan for our organization.
Work plan.
Including prioritization. And direct the work group to coordinate with federal agencies regarding barred owl
control.
Control.
Prescription.
What was that again?
Barred owl control experiments.
Control experiments. Ethical control experiments. No, I'm just kidding.
Recommended that DNR chair the implementation team.
Yeah, that's recommend DNR chair the work group. And we also direct the work group to convene a technical team.
To assess spatial and temporal allocation of conservation efforts.
Yep.
On the non-federal lands.
Yep.
Non-federal.
Using best available science.
Is there more data presented? And does that conform with your verbal recommendations, Darren?
It does.
Can I add a friendly amendment there? I think Darren said that the report was going to be in May, so can we put that up here?
Right, we need to have that in.
Oh, yeah.
I think direct the information group of five members to come back to the board in May with a work plan.
Maybe we can tack it on the PowerPoint.
Or just a report is due in
whatever.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I think it might be helpful to also specify that the department would report back to the board at the board's May meeting.
Yes.
As regards all aspects of the implementation work group's operations and how that group will conduct its business. As well as its needs or needs for facilitation.
Just put that back at the end of it. The work group is to report back to the Forest Practice Board in May regarding its progress.
Okay. Progress, operations, and need for facilitation would be good.
Can we add in best available science in that last sentence?
Sherry, did you catch that?
No, I got
but finish.
Coached for my class.
We'll let her catch up.
One, but
we'll do the cleanup.
And the best available science in your sentence?
Yeah, at the end of the sentence that ends on the non-federal lands, insert using best available science.
Okay.
Darren, is the intent here to keep engaged those members of the work group from those groups, from those so specified entities?
Make sure I understand the question.
To provide the continuity for the effort continuing on, is the intent here for those members of these constituencies so identified to continue on from the existing work group?
Right, correct.
Okay. I think that's important so we don't reinvent the wheel.
Yes, to the extent that we can take advantage of those same folks. Some of them may not be available, but we want to provide that continuity as best we can.
Okay.
Sherry, could you make the whole font a little larger for us, please?
Well, I think the group itself would probably figure out who from the land trust community would be appropriate to invite to participate. That would be my expectation. Yep. So, Darren, you want to take a crack at that, please?
There's a few places I'm going to have to interpret. Move that the board accept the consensus recommendation of the Spotted Owl Working Group and direct DNR to form the implementation working group of five members: DNR, DFW, Industry, Conservation Caucus, and a land trust group. Not sure what that next word is supposed to be.
Direct.
I would direct the implementation team to come back to the board with a work plan, including prioritization, and direct the work group to coordinate with the federal agencies with regard to barred owl control experiments. DNR will chair the team. Direct the work group to convene a technical team to assess spatial and temporal allocation of conservation efforts on non-federal land using best available science. DNR will report to the board in May. I think we missed a few of the words at the on the last sentence that Lenny had suggested.
We could modify the last sentence. Sherry, there, DNR will report to the board in May, including a proposal for how the implementation group will operate. Recommend whether the group needs facilitation.
And recommend?
Yep.
Excuse me, where is it?
Recommend whether the group needs facilitation. And bring a draft charter. There were several comments earlier today about the need for a very clear, crisp statement of what we will do moving ahead. And so a draft charter would help for the board to review.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Is that your motion, Dave?
That's exactly it.
I'll take it.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion properly supported before the board. Discussion on the motion. All right, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Thank you. Motion is unanimous. Sorry? Okay, that cleared up. Thank you very much. Thank you for that, and thank you, board, for the path forward here on this important issue. Then the next item on this morning or this afternoon's agenda is a landscape level wildlife assessments. We've been, Dave and others have been patient with us to get this amount of time on our schedule so they could make this presentation. Maybe even delayed a month or two, am I correct there?
Yeah, one meeting.
Okay, thank you for your patience. So you've only got 30 minutes to make up here. Just kidding.
We'd like to make a motion.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Again, my name is David Whipple, Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have with me today
Timothy Quinn, Dr. Timothy Quinn. He is Department of Fish and Wildlife's Habitat Program Chief Scientist, and he was the program manager for the landscape level wildlife assessment. George Will here, to my left, also research scientist for the department, and he was the landscape level wildlife assessment technical lead. Yes, today you'll get what we feel, I think, is a very important briefing on the assessment or the project. And in your packets, you have a memo from me and also a summary of the project, kind of an executive summary. And as you'll see, and as I think you've heard in the past, the project isn't finished quite yet. The work group, the technical group, got absolutely as far as they could and made a tremendous amount of progress with the money that we did have. And the stakeholders participated to a great extent. A lot of good, solid scientific work has been accomplished by all the stakeholders. Just in kicking this off, I think what we believe is the real take-home message today is that from the presentation is really, and Tim is really good at this and he'll do this, is what questions that this project can answer. So as we move forward, Tim will kind of explain, give you some examples of what kinds of questions this project is able to provide to you as the board. And I want to leave enough time for Tim and George to go through that, and we're going to do a little bit of a tag team here, so appreciate your patience.
So again, I'm Timothy Quinn, and here's the presentation outline. We'll give you a little bit of the background, general approach, demonstration of the results, summary, and next steps. We'll hope to answer or tell you about the policy implications as we go. First, a little bit of the background. This is part of the, as Dave suggested, it was part of the Forest Practice Board's wildlife work plan. This is item number 2 in that work plan, a landscape level wildlife assessment. The project goal was to determine statewide to what extent existing forest practice rules and other regulatory and voluntary measures on the landscape could contribute to conservation of forest-dependent wildlife. That stemmed from the idea that there was a fair amount of protection measures that were already part of the Forest Practice Board's work, and that no one had done an assessment of how those actions were contributing to wildlife in general, since most of them were focused on things like riparian protection, greenup rules, and so forth. Project expectations. What we really were setting out to do was to provide the scientific foundation for policy discussions and recommendations to you on landscape level approaches to wildlife conservation. This was different than a rule by rule, single species by single species approach. It was supposed to be more comprehensive and smarter. This is the best example of TFW cooperation. We had multiple stakeholder technical group was composed of scientists from these different working groups. We worked by consensus, which is no small matter. It takes longer, it costs more, but it results in a better product. And then, so this will be my last slide for a while. Basically, what we're going to tell you about today is the proof of concept, and that's no small deal. Again, we were working on a TFW framework where we were meeting consensus among scientists to bring you the best science available. And we achieved that very lofty goal and still were able to develop a number of important products. We have a process and a model for assessing habitat quality on forest lands for many wildlife species. We have a tool that can tell you how those wildlife species will fare under different management scenarios. So it's a gaming tool. You can grow forests in different ways and ask the question, how does this affect different species of wildlife? And then we have a custom software package. So this tool is actually transportable. It can be made available to other people. As long as you can provide input into the tool about what your forest conditions look like at different places in time, this tool, you can run this tool and determine outputs for wildlife. And with that, I'll turn this over to George Wilhair, project manager.
I think the slide isn't working on that.
Oh, sorry.
We also have a draft interim report
I call it interim because I'm an optimist. I think this, we're just in an interlude here between funding cycles, and the project will continue. And this interim report is in its second round of review by the technical team, and it should be done within a matter of weeks, if not days. The general approach. We take forest, well, first of all, this process we've developed is deceptively simple. We take forest growth models. We take the outputs of those forest growth models, which can model a variety of different silvicultural scenarios. We put those into habitat models for a large number of different wildlife species, and at the other end comes an assessment of habitat quality for these various forest conditions. The species we addressed were almost all vertebrates that use managed forest land in Washington. What we did not address were those species that have a critical habitat role, such as spotted owl or marble murrelets and salmon. We did not cover other species that are already covered by the wildlife work plan, the main one being the western gray squirrel. And we did not cover species that do not use or do not have a significant use of commercial forest land. We had one model for every guilder species, which turned out to be quite a lot. And we had two types of models. The first model is called a Bayesian belief network. The Bayesian belief network is a detailed quantitative model in which expert knowledge about the relationships between forest conditions and habitat quality are expressed as probabilities. We use the BBNs because we have a lot of uncertainty in our knowledge and we needed to express those. The probabilities are an expression of that uncertainty. The results I'm going to show you will be probabilities. We'll have a probability of a stand being habitat and a probability of a stand being high quality habitat. We only did 28 of these models because they're very labor intensive. The literature reviews and supporting documentation for many of these models are 40 to 50 pages long. For the rest of the species, about 154, we did species habitat matrix models, which we also called JNO, that's our shorthand for it, named after the two gentlemen that developed the database upon which these models are based. These are qualitative models. There's no expression of uncertainty. They're simpler to do. So our habitat quality is based on habitat elements within stands, the size of and density of snags, the size and density of trees, the stand conditions, such as canopy closure, shrub cover within the stand, landscape conditions, such as the amount of habitat within a home range for a species, or the distance to a stream for those species that are associated with streams. We did not use stand age or cereal stage. Now, this is important because we wanted to be able, first of all, to tease apart those elements within the forest that species are responding to. Are they responding to the size of snags, the density of snags, the size of trees? And also, we wanted to be able to manipulate stands so that we might be able to produce habitat more efficiently. If you try to base management just on stand age, you may not be as efficient if you're just keeping the stand age constant, but retaining more snags or retaining more trees. So we want to be able to look at those different types of silvicultural options. For our demonstration assessment, we picked five landscapes within Western Washington. We're also capable of doing modeling on the east side, but because of time constraints, we just use the west side. These five landscapes were quarter townships, about 9 square miles, which is a little bit more than 5,000 acres. For each of these landscapes, we developed what we call synthetic landscapes in GIS. This is an example of one of those five. The blue is our streams, buffered according to the forest and fish rules. These brown areas are unstable hill slopes, based on a model. These areas with the slashing and the pink buffering are wetlands, buffered according to the forest practices rules. The red lines are roads. The various shades of green represent different stand ages across the landscape. We did a 50-year forest management simulation for each of the five landscapes. We had three management scenarios. The first one is the old rules, pre-forest and fish, and we based that on the EIS that was done for the forest and fish rules back in 2001. We did the current rules, including forest and fish. We used option two with no harvest in the interzone. I know that's unrealistic, but because of our time constraints, we had to do a simple version of option two. We intend to rectify that if we get a chance in the future. The third management scenario was called an alternative snag management scenario. where we use the current rules plus some more snag and tree retention. For all the scenarios, all the other forest practices rules were the same. The unstable hill slopes, which we've mapped, were the same. And we used the same silvicultural regime, which was about a 45-year rotation. As Tim mentioned, we developed this assessment software, which is no small deal. It saved us considerable time in doing the simulations and the data analysis. We invested a lot of time and money into building this software. Now it's time for the demonstration results. Here's a disclaimer, which I hope you all pay careful attention to. This habitat assessment is only a demonstration of the project's capabilities and utility to policymakers. Some aspects of the project are incomplete, and therefore the results should not be used to draw any inferences about habitat quality for wildlife in private commercial forests. So we're not done yet. We still have a lot of work to do. It's not completed nor perfected. We need to have an external review of the habitat models. We're not sure that the models are giving the correct output because we haven't had a full range of experts review them and give us their opinions. We need to do more realistic simulation of the forest and fish rules, option two, as I mentioned earlier. And we discovered in this process, during this demonstration, that our tree mortality models probably aren't as good as we'd like them to be. We need to improve those. So here's one result. One of the simplest things we can do is to rank the species from those that do not so well in managed forests to those that do the best. So shrub nesting birds, out of the 13 guilds or species that we looked at, shrub nesting birds did the best. They have about a 0.95 probability of a stand being habitat. Another way of looking at that, if you had 100 stands across the landscape, on average, about 95 of those would be habitat. Forest bats and red-breasted sapsucker were sort of in the middle, about a 0.5 probability of a stand being habitat. So again, on average, about half the landscape would be habitat. And conifer-associated cavity nesters did the worst. The other way of looking at habitat is high-quality habitat. So we have habitat, high-quality habitat. And again, we just arrange them in order from worst to best. So we can see how species do relative to each other. So this was the forest and fish rule scenario at year 50 for all five landscapes. We can take those two one-dimensional axes and plot them in two dimensions to look for different patterns, relationships. So here we have a bunch of species that tend to do well. They have high average probability of habitat and a moderate to high probability of high quality habitat. So these species are probably okay. These species have a lower probability of average probability of habitat, low values, and they also have low values for the average probability of high quality habitat. So these species, according to our models, which have not been reviewed yet, aren't doing so well.
Yes. So if I could say one thing, one of the reasons we engaged in this project was the Forest Practice Board considers over 250 species of vertebrates on managed forests. That's part of your mandate. That's a lot of complexity. And one of the ways you can use this tool is to try to reduce this complexity into a smaller subset of species that might not be faring as well on managed forest landscapes. So this takes this huge amount of complexity and reduces it to a more manageable subset that you might consider.
We can also look at the sort of landscape level response. So here is the same landscape at the same point in time, with the same management for two different species. So pileated woodpecker, as you can see here, if it's red, it has a low probability of habitat. Pileated woodpecker has a 0.18 probability of a stand being habitat. So it's mostly red. It's not doing so well, except for the buffers. Forest and fish buffers tend to be green or light green. The hairy woodpecker, on the other hand, has mostly dark green, which is a high probability of being habitat. So most of the landscape for the hairy woodpecker provides habitat. You can also compare scenarios. So on the horizontal axis, we have the average probability of habitat under the old forest practices rules, pre-forest and fish. On the vertical axis, we have the average probability under the current rules of a standing habitat. If one of the black points falls on the red line, there's no change between the two scenarios. Points that are above the red line do better under the current rules compared to the old rules. So you can see there is improvement for most of the species. So species up here, you wouldn't expect to have a change. They're already doing quite well under the old rules, so you couldn't gain much improvement under the current rules. Species down here, we do see a change, not a big change, and why is that? There are two reasons. One is the buffers for the five landscapes that we simulated, on average, were about 15% of the landscape. So 15% of the landscape were unstable slopes, RMZs, wetland management zones. So they're only 15%. And the other fact, which is interesting, we didn't see a big change because we only simulated up 50 years. To get the full benefits from forests and fish, we'd have to go out a much longer period of time, maybe 100 years or more. We can also compare habitat quality within the protection zones, as I call them for this presentation, versus upland units. So I define protection zones as core and inner zones of the RMZ, type N buffers, unstable slopes, and wetland management zones. Again, if you're on the black line, there's no difference between upland areas and protection zones. Species above this black diagonal line improve or have better habitat quality in these protection zones. So almost all species have much higher habitat quality in what I'm calling protection zones. The only one that does worse are shrub birds, because there's no shrubs, or fewer shrubs in these older forests that are in the protection zones. Let's look at one of these species, brown creeper, and ask ourselves, why is there a difference between upland areas and these protection zones? Well, we can look at the habitat elements. So we can see on the right here, in the upland areas, there's a smaller density of these large trees. In the protection zones, there's a much higher density of these large trees. So that's one explanation for why brown creeper is doing better in these protection zones. Same thing for large snags. The densities in the upland areas are much lower than in these protection zones.
So one attribute of this is helps you address the question of aside from talking about cereal stage or amounts of cereal stage on the landscape, you can actually refine your discussion when you're dealing with wildlife protection issues. You could refine your discussion to those specific elements of the forest as opposed to forest age, overall stand age. And it's a much finer scalpel or a much finer process for looking at what's necessary as opposed to just stand age.
We can also compare the landscapes. So along the horizontal axis, we have the 13 species or guilds. This axis is the average probability of a standing habitat for each of the landscapes. We have five landscapes with these different symbols. At the high end, where species do well, they tend to do well everywhere. So shrub birds, generalist burrows, cavity nesting ducks, they have high probabilities regardless of where you are. At the low end, we can see there's some variation. Landscape 8 tends to have lower average probabilities for all these species. Landscape 3 tends to have higher average probabilities for all these species. So there's some difference in the landscapes. It's at the same point in time, the same silvicultural regime, so it's something about the landscape that's making landscape 3 have higher average probability of habitat. And there are three things that we can attribute this to. One is the area in protection zones. Landscape 3 has a higher percentage. Another is the site index. That W3 also has a higher site index on average. And also the stand ages. The distribution of stand ages due to past harvests is slightly higher in that landscape. So we can take this information and ask ourselves, well, how can we manage W8? We can use our models to say, how can we manage landscape 8 in a different way to bring it up to the same level as landscape 3? So the results I showed you before were for our BBN models. Those were all the probability outputs. This is for the qualitative model outputs for 54 species on the west side. You can see that the vast majority of them do quite well under the forest and fish rule scenario in year 50. Some of them do less well, but that's not because of the management. That's because these species were associated with meadows or riparian areas that are a small percentage of the landscape just naturally. That's it for the results. Now a summary. So what have we got? We have tools for landscape assessment. We have 28 BBN models covering 77 species. We have wildlife habitat relationships models for 154 species. We have this custom assessment software that really accelerates the time to do these types of assessments. And we have most of the process for the assessment. We have these synthetic landscapes, which we can, we know how to build. We have a process developed to build them. And we have a collegial and cooperative technical team, which actually adds a lot to our ability to produce high quality products. What can we do? We can project habitat outcomes resulting from different types of forest management. We can rank these species based on habitat quality to get a sense for which species are doing just great on managed forests and which species may need some extra help. We can simulate real scenarios for real landscapes. We can assess which habitat elements have the biggest impact on habitat quality. Is it snags, is it downwood, is it shrub cover? We can explore how forest practice rules interact with landscape level characteristics. Is the response due to the RMZs? Is it due to wetland management zones? Is the response due to the snag rules? And then we can modify rules to see how species respond to those modifications. And we can investigate the long-term wildlife habitat benefits of the forest and fish rules. We haven't done it yet. As I said, we only simulated 50 years. If we were to go out longer, we'd probably see a bigger response in terms of habitat quality for many of these species. Next steps. We need to complete the interim report. That will be done shortly. We need to obtain funding to complete the assessment. We're thinking about $500,000. The minimum task we need to complete the assessment tools. We have 10 more BVNs, which the technical team thought were necessary to get a better feel for the impacts of forest management. We need to have a more extensive review of these models by other scientists. We need to establish initial stand conditions. We originally thought we would use data from private landowners to establish those stand conditions. We still might. If not, we may have to use some remote sensing to do that. We need to work on our tree mortality models to get a better, more accurate projection of snag densities over time. And then once those tools are developed, we'll be ready to do the actual assessment across the state.
So just to add a little bit more context on the tail end of this, some of you will recall a long time ago now that during the final board actions on forest and fish, a lot of the board members were talking about the board's activity on forest and fish at that point was kind of winding down. The forest and fish rules were becoming adopted or had been adopted or were close to being adopted. And there was a lot of interest on the board to kind of get back to wildlife and find out, so now what's happening, because so much time had been spent on the aquatic resources. And so back in probably, I think it was 2003, the board adopted a wildlife work plan. And as Tim mentioned, this is element two of the work plan, which has actually four elements. Element one is the assessment of current rules, mainly pertaining to the T&E species under the critical wildlife habitat state. Owls was the first species that was done, and we've been working a lot on owls over the past few years. And meanwhile, element two has been kind of churning in the background, making some really good progress and coming up with good products that can help understand what issues might be out there, but also what might be able to be done in the future in hopes of, I think, keeping these species which are not listed from becoming listed. And element three is important to remember what that one is. That's the incentives piece. And I think way back in 03 when this thing was put together, it was recognized that incentives are going to be playing a pretty significant role, or should play a role, in trying to figure out how to kind of implement the results of the landscape assessment. And You know, and I think this assessment shows that, that there are many species that do rather well in the managed forest context. And there are some that, that don't do so well. And so I think we, next steps are, is we need to finish the project, secure funding somehow, finish the project, get these models peer reviewed so that it's actually usable, and see what we can come up with. And I think that through the discussions with the Spotted Owl work group and the subsequent work on that, some of these incentives ideas that we're working through with the owl may come into play in terms of these species as well. And anyway, we just recognize the value of those incentives, and that was an important role in the original work plan. So we've had some issues with obviously with the funding. I think we had two different appropriations by the legislature. Both, if I'm not mistaken, had proviso language in the budget bill that, that said something like one-time funding to complete the project, even though everyone knew that, that it was going to take a lot more than what was appropriated, and DNR was generous in contributing some funds a year or so ago. But it, we're not done yet, and we need some more money in order to finish this project. And Tim might be able to speak to it better than I, but from what I understand, this group, the stakeholder group, which had a wide range of representation, kind of took the existing science and pushed it well beyond what the original developers had envisioned. And it's going to be a really valuable tool. And if they can get some papers published out of it, that might help in the funding issue as well. So, yeah.
So I'd just like to add one more perspective. As Dave mentioned, our preliminary findings showed that managed forest landscapes contribute habitat, appear to contribute a habitat for lots of species. And one of the things that we discussed in our work group that we never got quite around to doing because we're running out of money was to explain how development or loss of private forest land affects wildlife species, a big part of the story nowadays. And I think we could make that part of our mandate if we get additional funding to show the public exactly what's happening as we lose our managed forests.
When did this assessment start?
Conceptually, it started in about 2002. I look back in my files. We had been talking about this among the different stakeholder groups for some time. I think we received our first allocation of money in 2007.
So that's when the work started?
Correct.
Okay. Questions from the board?
I had a question actually early on in your slides. It looked to me like you were making a distinction between habitat quality and habitat availability. And I didn't quite understand that. How do you reckon habitat quality?
We had two types of habitat. What we called the habitat, or low quality habitat, and high quality habitat. High quality habitat you can think of as self-sustaining habitat. If you have only low quality habitat, the species are not self-sustaining. They would eventually disappear from that landscape. But if you, some portion of that landscape, we don't know what that proportion is high quality habitat, then that landscape is self-sustaining for that species.
So that's different from availability. I'm thinking of cavity nesting critters. So high quality, isn't that just more opportunities for cavity nesting?
Well, high quality is related to the demographic parameters, such as survivorship and fecundity. So high quality habitat would have high reproductive rates. Low quality habitat would have lower reproductive rates.
Okay, so you're just saying based on performance of different species within those areas, you rate them as high or low?
Well, based on our reading of the literature.
Yeah. But I, for some reason, I thought that you were predicting that certain types of growth models or regulations were producing better quality habitat as well as maybe more habitat. And I just didn't understand how you rated the quality versus quantity.
Well, it's both. I mean, we're looking at the quantity of each stand has a score, essentially. And that score reflects its habitat quality. The quality is, the score is expressed as a probability. Let's think of it as a score. Every stand has a score, and there's some threshold score that relates to split stands as either high quality or low quality.
Based on the performance of different species in those.
Well, based on the habitat attributes of that stand. Yeah.
But there is both a quantity and a quality aspect to the model output.
But you don't need to. Well, that's okay, I got it.
Yes.
Well, first, thank you for your presentation. I know it's been a long time coming too, and I certainly appreciate it. Just thinking of other possible uses for this, Tim, do you think that it could be manipulated to have some of the projected impacts that are being discussed for climate change for particular habitats as well, since there are many efforts that will be hopefully needing to use that information?
If you knew the answer.
I will give the class a scientist answer. This is appropriate to a number of management issues, including climate change. As we envisioned this, and particularly the software, we thought about making this accessible to forest managers everywhere, such that if they wanted to consider how to spend their next dollar most wisely towards conservation of a species, this would help identify that. And the question about how climate change is going to affect, it's a brilliant question, Anna. As you all know, the effect of climate change on forest communities is going to be fairly dramatic, as some current projections suggest. And we expect that to have fairly dramatic impacts on fish and wildlife that occupy those stands. So, yeah, it's a good question.
And just a quick follow-up question, not a follow-up, but separate. Do you think that even without additional funding that you'll be able to publish initial results, assuming more peer reviews?
I think we will. I think we've made, and as Dave kindly mentioned, we really have made extraordinary progress. We've pushed this application of this type of model to a new place. There's been a number of people who have talked about it, but we set up a process, a consensus-based process, that really made this type of modeling a useful tool. And we've also developed some other processes that make it more accessible to other people, so that the idea would be we can tell you how to do this if you're starting off on another part of the world, if you're starting off with this process of using available information to make better management decisions, we can tell you how to get there from here. We were the first ones to push it to this level of application, and we've learned some really valuable lessons that we can share with folks.
Norm?
I really appreciate the report that all three of you have presented here, and especially I know that it's been a long time in process, a long time coming, and that it really was a consensus-based process all along. And I hope that all the work that you've done does find the funding that is necessary to allow it to get to completion at some point in time, and that's probably not going to be real soon given economic conditions, but hopefully it can be, I'd say, mothballed rather than disposed of and very very soon resurrected. But I think it will be a valuable tool for us when we've found ways that we can use it for implementation, and we've gotten peer review and those kinds of things and been able to test a little more fully. Question that I have, and I know that there's going to be a wide range of answers, so you can give me a wide range of answer. But when you've done these VBN models or other models for species or for guilds, I would suspect that there's a level of uncertainty of knowledge about any of these species or their reactions to stand conditions. And for some of those, that range is pretty small, and for others, that range is pretty large. Could you give us an idea of that level of certainty or uncertainty?
I think there's two answers, and I'll let George answer first on how we tried to capture that uncertainty in the model specifically.
So as I said, the reason we adopted the BBN approach is because they're designed to capture uncertainty. The probabilities, a probability is an expression of uncertainty. So I didn't show it in this presentation, but there are other ways to graph the uncertainty, to calculate the uncertainty associated with each of the models. So every model, there's a model for each species, has a different level of uncertainty. For some species, we think we know better what their habitat requirements are than other species. But for across the range of species, we can graph that uncertainty. So when, if you ever comes the day when we make decisions about these things, we'll know what that uncertainty is.
And then I would just add that George says that the only way we got there was adopting a model that incorporated uncertainty explicitly. And I would argue that we would not have necessarily, I don't think we would have reached consensus. I don't think we would have gotten as far as we got unless we would have had this type of modeling process. And the great thing about the modeling process, as George suggested, is it goes from having very little hard data that could go into a model, basically expert opinion, all the way to trying to incorporate maybe up to 20 papers that have informed habitat associations. So, and the modeling platform allows you to keep to do it across that spectrum of input, from the relatively good amounts of data to the relatively poor.
Thank you. Sharon.
Having worked on this project a little bit, I wonder where we lost the original policy call of assessing the landscape. As I refresh my memory here, Ken, but it seemed like we had a conversation for a year or two about the fact that smalls and larges wanted to be identified on the landscape as to the wildlife habitat they were providing. So we've got off that track, obviously.
Huh? Well. So just to maybe to get everybody up to speed, we had a sub objective under our broad objective, and that was to look specifically at the urbanizing fringe so that we could try to address the question of, and I think mostly related to small forest landowners maintaining their forests versus conversion, and what were the trade-offs in terms of wildlife species. And the short answer is we failed because we ran out of money. The a little bit more complex answer is we have a tool that would work for that, but we never got very far in crafting the models associated with loss of forest. Most of our models are looking at changes within forests, and we would have to craft models that ask specifically what happens when you lose trees, when you lose the forest structure and you've gone to an urbanizing area. So we think we probably could have told an even better story had we done those contrasts with urbanizing fringe and forest, because I think the contrast would have been stark. We just ran out of funding.
If you do get funding, maybe we can prioritize that.
We would be delighted to work with you again, Sherry.
So I want to join other members from the board in thanking you for this work. As someone who, for me, reason for coming on the Forest Practice Board was to look at the wildlife issues, and it looked pretty grim there for a while because of the funding problem. So I'm just really pleased at how far you've been able to push it. And as I'm thinking about the work so far and what could lie ahead, are you looking at quite a diverse range of funding sources, like foundations, so forth? Because it seems like you might be able to hook up with some, you know, there probably are foundations out there that have this focus, particularly the forest landscapes and the concern about conversion or on the urbanizing fringe and so forth.
We've actually submitted two proposals, neither of which were funded, but we are looking for ways to try to complete this. As George says, when he put up that summary slide, and I think it's in your document, we're not that far from having a document or a process that we have consensus on to use as a management tool. That's a big deal. So it's basically 10 more BBM models and the peer review process, correct me if I've left it, but it's 10 more BBMs, three of which have been started, and the peer review process to be able to do the assessment.
You have some final comments there, Dave?
Yes, thank you. I was just going to add that as part of the wildlife Upland Wildlife Update, I'll be keeping you folks apprised of any efforts that we put together, any grant requests or whatever we do, and what the success of those is or is not. And also, when it's available, if we end up getting a paper published, we'll make sure to get a copy of that to you folks as well. We'll keep you posted.
All right. Thank you very much for your efforts. We appreciate your report. So next, public comment on the Watershed Analysis Committee report. I think we'll march right on with that. We have five members of the public. Arthur West has signed up.
Thank you very much. I don't want to waste your time. I'm not very familiar with this. I'd just like to speak to any of the actions the board takes today. If it's based on recommendations that have not been vetted by the public, that have been made by quasi-private associations like the Washington State Association of Cities, any rule adoptions based upon that type of bad public process are legally deficient, and I hope you exercise your option to have an executive session at the end of this proceeding if you're going to be adopting any of these rules, especially the ones in regard to riparian sections, because that seems to be significantly cutting down the ability of the regulations to protect things. And I think the watershed protections we have right now aren't adequate, so weakening them at all is a very bad thing to do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. West. Scott Swanson.
Thank you, Commissioner Goldmark, and board members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today. As I've said before, my name is Scott Swanson. I'm manager and vice president of West Fork Timber Company. I've been in front of you before on this particular topic. You should have a letter, or you do have a letter from me explaining our position, urging you to adopt the consensus recommendations in their entirety as proposed by your Watershed Analysis Committee. As you've heard from me before, West Fork Timber owns and operates a family-owned 55,000-acre tree farm in eastern Lewis County. I would like to read right now just a bit from the letter that you have in front of you. By way of background, West Fork has worked closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Washington Department of Natural Resources for years to implement the terms of the Endangered Species Act with a habitat conservation plan and our incidental take permit. West Fork has likewise spent millions of dollars in several years developing and implementing watershed analysis and mass wasting prescriptions in the context of its incidental take permit. As evidenced in a January 8, 2010 letter from the Fish and Wildlife Service to DNR, which you have also in front of you, West Fork's mass wasting prescriptions are working well and are protective of the environment. As noted by the committee, an ample basis exists to conclude that private holders of incidental take permits such as West Fork that incorporate watershed analysis and permit the use of mass wasting prescriptions based upon watershed analysis should maintain Class 4 exemptions that currently exist under law. West Fork believes it important to point out that the committee has served an important role on behalf of the board in evaluating these matters. Members of the committee met numerous times on numerous occasions over the course of several months to discuss in detail the range of legal and practical issues associated with mass placing prescriptions. And I'd like to just thank each one of the members of the board on that committee for taking that amount of time and taking this issue seriously. The committee heard from all interested parties that were interested in participating in this discussion during the development of its consensus recommendations. And the resulting consensus recommendations reflect a careful consideration of the issues and should now be adopted by the board without further delay. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Scott. Jim Lynch.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Commissioner, members of the board. Thank you for an opportunity to provide brief comments on the consensus recommendations that are before you now. I would just like to echo a few comments made by Mr. Swanson on these consensus recommendations. As Scott noted, there's a letter in your packet concerning Westport's position on the consensus recommendations, along with a letter that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has written on behalf of folks that hold these incidental take permits. As you'll see in that letter, the Fish and Wildlife Service agrees with the folks such as Westport to have these HCPs, that processes that HCPs that adopt mass wasting prescriptions and watershed analysis are reliable, they're working well. It's a process that I think as a board you should want to encourage. Parties like Westport Timber have spent a lot of money and time doing the right thing here, developing programs that are enacted in federal law that are reviewed consistently by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with input from DNR and other stakeholders. And we want to encourage those types of processes to continue on and let folks realize the benefits of what they negotiated. I think it's important for the board to recognize that the folks that served on the committee spent a lot of time and effort trying to reach consensus on these recommendations. The document you have in front of you, I think, is highly detailed. It reflects careful consideration of the issues. These are complicated issues, as you all know. I think the members of the committee should be applauded for the work that they have undertaken. This process has worked well. We're very supportive of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Adrian Miller. Good afternoon, Adrian.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the board. I'm Adrian Miller with Washington Forest Protection Association. The Washington Forest Protection Association supports the consensus recommendations from the Mass Wasting Subcommittee of the board. WFPA encourages the board to adopt these recommendations as presented by the subcommittee. As Jim noted, these are lengthy and detailed. However, these recommendations effectively support implementing the current rule. Recommendations also provide direction to the Department of Natural Resources on how the department can implement the existing rules to address concerns presented during the board and subcommittee meetings. Collectively, these recommendations accomplish the following. They provide assurances that the prescriptions can be utilized by landowners who rely on them as part of their federally issued incidental take permits. They ensure that all watersheds are prioritized for review by the department. For those watersheds where a review is determined to be necessary, the department has the option to request or compel a landowner to augment their mass wasting avoidance strategy during the review period if justified. In the event that that is not effective in the department's light, the department can consider asking for additional authority or conditioning at that time. It also provides an option for landowners to adopt the current rural mass wasting avoidance strategy as the revised prescriptions. WFPA does not feel that it is warranted at this time to embark on rulemaking activity to address the issues presented to the board with respect to mass wasting prescriptions. To do so would require going through the adaptive management process first. Currently, there are at least two mass wasting studies underway pending the peer review step in the adaptive management process. The board should not consider initiating any rulemaking until the results of those studies are made available and the subsequent adaptive management process is completed. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Adrian.
Welcome.
Peter Goldman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Afternoon again, Peter Goldman, Washington Forest Law Center, representing the Conservation Caucus. Watershed analysis was a good idea at first. A landowner, DNR, and other stakeholders could scientifically identify upfront protective measures in a watershed that, if implemented, would avoid FPA by FPA Class 4 special review. It was a good idea in theory. And in fact, over the pre-forest and fish rules, there were improvements in many watersheds. But that was 1992, and today it's 2010. 18 years later, DNR has virtually no program for watershed analysis. What's left of the team to conduct the five-year reviews? Who's making the call at DNR whether it's necessary to do a watershed analysis? These things are required in the rules. Who's watching the watersheds to see if there were natural disasters that have material effects. That's right out of the rules. Who's doing the monitoring? The reality is that all the research stays around forest and fish. In fact, I don't mean, there could be some good watershed analysis out there, including West Fork, but the facts are to the contrary. The results of the DNR post-mortem study so far, that out of the 12, according to our analysis, out of the 1,273 landslides, 64% of those from the December 2007 storm occurred in watershed watershed analysis. In the January 09 storm, 232 of the 313, 74% occurred in watersheds using the watershed analysis mass wasting prescriptions. These are egregious numbers. This is more of a loophole at this point than it is something that's helping the environment. We obviously need something that retains some of the good, but we cannot go on and pretend that we're monitoring these watershed analyses when we have site-specific review required and prescribed under the forest and fish rules. So the bottom line is our caucus is, we've submitted two letters, most recently one February 5. We don't believe that this board should allow landowners to continue using mass wasting prescriptions of unknown effectiveness without the necessary 5-year review. It's not just bad policy, it's illegal. The rules don't allow it. The subcommittee allows FPAs to continue without the 5-year reviews, and that shouldn't go on. And we have multiple steep slope screening tools that were not available back in the early 90s that we now know are telling us things about watersheds that we need to implement right now. Watershed analysis can't be fixed with a Band-Aid. Our caucus asks for the opportunity to work with DNR and other stakeholders on a credible fix. Otherwise, we'll have no option but to petition the board to revoke the watershed analysis rule in rulemaking, and we'll be forced to appeal forest practice applications that were granted approved under forest watershed analyses that were simply have not undergone what's required in the regs themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. So that concludes the public comment period for the watershed analysis topic. It's 23 right now, or almost quarter till. I think we'll probably go ahead, although there's going to be at least 40 minutes, I think we'll probably forge on ahead with the committee report at this time. Welcome, Chuck.
Mr. Chair and members of the board, good afternoon. My name is Chuck Turley. I'm the Deputy Supervisor for Regulatory Programs. The presentation about the consensus recommendations is going to be made to you by at least some of the members of the committee itself at their request. Before they do that, though, I do want to briefly just to kind of reset the context here of what it is we're talking about. Put a graph up here with some numbers that comes out of analysis that the Forest Practice Division has done over the past year. When we talk about approved watershed analyses, there are 52 of them, and those consist of 69 watershed administrative units. Some of the watershed analyses contain more than one. Wow. Back in 09, the operational section of the Forest Practice Division did some analysis of those 42 approved watershed analyses. They identified 252 mass wasting prescriptions that they reviewed. Some of those prescriptions have multiple elements to them, and if you split out all of those elements, there were a total of 647 separate prescriptions that they reviewed. And the reason this review was conducted is that the rules are specific that only those prescriptions which are specific are supposed to be utilized. Those that are non-specific or simply require additional analysis should not be being moved forward, should not be being allowed to continue to be used. They reviewed all 647 of those, and they determined that out of those, 392 met the specificity threshold, but 255 of those did not, 39%. And the operations section then took steps, working with our regions, to inform them of the determination of which ones should be being used, which ones should not, and instructed them to review and approve applications going forward appropriately. We believe within the program this was a major step towards addressing the issue of inappropriate use of the watershed analysis. I'm not going to say it may be the complete answer, but I don't want this sight of this step to get lost to the board. We've also looked at the analysis in terms of, are there some of them where mass wasting is not an issue, so is irrelevant in this discussion? Three of them are, so that takes the number down to 49. Three of them are 100% mass wasting prescriptions. They contain no other prescriptions within them. One analysis had 100% prescriptions that we determined to be nonspecific, and since the direction has now been given that those should not be used, that one comes out of the mix. So that takes that number up above of 52 to be a part of this discussion, down to 48. We also looked at the an issue that you've heard about is the inclusion of these in private landowners' habitat conservation plans. There are six private landowner HCP holders that have approved analysis mass wasting prescriptions in their HCPs: West Fork, Plum Creek, Green Diamond, DNR State Lands, Tacoma Public Utilities, and Broughton. And those six HCPs include a total of 17 of these watershed analyses. So when we hear landowners raising concern about how many of these are included in their HCPs, that's the scope of about a third of the ones we're talking about. So that kind of sets the context. If you remember, we have had discussions at I think every board meeting over the past year about what to do about the mass wasting prescriptions. And that led to, several meetings ago, Mr. Schaaf making a motion, basically at my request, that we form a committee of the board to work with me and with DNR staff to try to develop recommendations to bring back to you. Four board members, Mr. Schaaf, Ms. Fox, Mr. Pereira, and Mr. Lowry, participated in that, and I believe Norm is going to lead the discussion of presenting those recommendations to you. At the end of that, once you've had whatever discussion you want to have and are starting to kind of coalesce around what to do about these, Darren's going to come up and talk with you about what action it is that the board would need to take for us to do that.
Thanks, Chuck, for that introduction. And I actually asked that be part of this presentation so we would have a level of context of just how many watershed analyses we are talking about, especially as we enter into discussion about review and how that might be done. First of all, why I'm making this presentation is the others punted to me, I guess, or chickened out or something like that. So hopefully these remarks represent the consensus of this group. And as had been brought up in testimony, we really did work hard to reach consensus. I think we met five times, starting out with the notion that we wanted to find a way to solve the issues that were brought forward by forest practices staff. We wanted to try to do this in a consensus fashion. We wanted to try to do this, if at all possible, without engaging in rulemaking, because we thought that was an easier way to get to a solution than entering into a long process that also would require a great deal of staff and other resources in that rulemaking process. And then finally, that it was an open process that we would certainly permit and welcome others to listen in and to participate. As part of our deliberations in all of these, we heard presentations, a number of presentations by staff. We had presentations by two of the holders of HCPs that have utilized watershed analyses, that being Plum Creek and West Fork Timber. And you'll see that that's actually one of the recommendations later on that all of you are able to hear those as well. We think they're very helpful in our understanding. We had a presentation by the Environmental Caucus. Cara Whitaker presented that to us as well. So let me go into the recommendations, if I may, and just I'm not going to read them all to you, but I'd like to just highlight a few things about them as we go through. And they are up on the board, and I think you probably have them all in your packets as well. So first of all, we recommended that that this board does support the continued use of watershed analyses, mass wasting prescriptions, as further contemplated in these recommendations. That is, we did not want to just throw this system out and engage in different rulemaking around that. The second recommendation deals with the delineation of specific and non-specific watershed analysis mass wasting prescriptions, and refers specifically to a memo from Julie Sackett and the DNR staff about how that delineation of specific and non-specific could have some review that would engage stakeholders as part of that process, recognizing that it is still DNR's responsibility to make that delineation and that determination, but that when it had initially been done, it was done strictly by DNR and did not include any stakeholder participation. This would allow for that participation as requested by the various stakeholders in that process. We again would like to have the board hear those presentations of findings from the five-year reviews that have been completed, specifically those that were done by Plum Creek and by West Fork Timber. We think that those companies that have engaged in getting habitat conservation plans and the incidental take permits should continue to be able to utilize the forest practices classification and class 4 exemptions that exist under law when they continue to utilize the mass wasting prescriptions as are stated within those habitat conservation plans. For the areas in which the reviews have not been done, we see a path forward in which the DNR can work with the landowners, first of all, on a voluntary basis, and within forest practices, whenever there is a particularly in a either a class 4 special or in a priority review of forest practices, there is always the opportunity for the landowner to accept voluntary conditions on the forest practice. And the acceptance of those voluntary conditions then becomes part of their approval. It no longer is voluntary at that point. It becomes conditional to them at that point in time. And we believe that that presents an opportunity in most cases, if not even all cases, that where it has been determined that additional protections beyond prescriptions may be necessary, the landowner can voluntarily accept these conditions. And again, those do become part of their rule, and that this can be done without the need for additional rulemaking. It is simply a process by which DNR engages the landowner that is applying in those particular areas. We agree that there needs to be a process and a priority system to determine when and how reviews of watershed analysis prescriptions needs to occur. And as was just brought up by Chuck, it looks to me, if my count is right, that there are maybe in the neighborhood of 31 analyses that need review That is, if all the ones that are within the HCPs have undergone review. If that number isn't quite right, it might increase that number just a little bit. So it's not a huge universe of watershed analyses that need review. It's fairly limited, and it's limited in scope to the watershed analyses prescription. So that is something that can be done in a fairly short order of time. But this would set up a process for determining priority system. The DNR would set up this process to prioritize and begin to schedule those. The certification and qualification of those that are doing this review may need some modification, but there are certainly the qualified individuals available that that can do this work. And it's just a it's sort of an artifact of the way in which there was a lapse in the continued certification of these professionals that puts us to where we are. It's not a lack of ability or a lack of people out there that could do it. And for some reason, my sheet lost
the next two. It's on the next page.
There they are. Thank you. This is why we're a team.
It's not reassuring.
In instances, this particularly came up with landowners that that have found themselves in watersheds where there's a lot of non-specific prescriptions. It creates difficulty both for DNR and for the landowner. And we'd like to see an opportunity by which, particularly in those cases, or while a watershed analysis is in review, that the landowner can simply agree to accept the current rule, which would follow the standard rules in the forest and fish agreement, rather than whatever watershed analysis prescriptions might be in place in that area. And then finally, that the board continue to utilize any additional information, the CEMER studies that are underway, and other information as we continue to consider what rulemaking may be required. As was brought up in one of the testimonies, that study is underway. It is, I think, close to coming to us, but is not quite completed yet, and we can certainly benefit from that. In the meantime, in the interim, we believe that adopting this resolution by this board, forwarding it on to the commissioner for implementation by the department, essentially at this point, as a recommendation from this board, will allow us to begin the reviews, will allow us to utilize current rules where those are necessary to achieve the protections, will protect the public resources, but will also recognize and protect those landowners that have utilized the habitat conservation plans and are already doing the reviews, and protects their status as well. So those are our recommendations. As I said, those were consensus, and we had a lot of discussion about it. Appreciated all of the different ideas that came up. So I'll just ask me if any of the other members have any other comments.
Thanks for starting on the storm. I think I agree with everything you said. We were focusing on what can we do without rulemaking, because the adaptive management system really is backed up on that, and it's a cost to us all. One of the key things for me, though, in all of this, well, I mean, as Norm said, we learned, and Scott's example was just really quite striking. We learned that some people that are keeping up with watershed analysis are doing quite a remarkable job and have a good product. So I think that was one of the things that convinced us that we need to try to keep those in place. But at the same time, looking at the ones that haven't been reviewed are not up to date. In recommendation five, we say, we recommend, the board recommend that DNR use existing enforcement authority to achieve protection of public resources on a site-specific basis as needed, basically. That's the regulatory backstop that I was looking for as we go through kind of a process to bring these other ones up to speed. I was looking at that as obvious source of protecting public resources. There's some question about the ability to do that under the current rules with watershed analysis. And I don't think we really got that sorted out. There are discussions maybe still going on within DNR about its ability to do that without rulemaking. So I'm not sure if we're going to get into that today or not. But it's to me, it's one of those, it's a key aspect to making this all work together, though, is having that backstop in place. So let me get into that more. But I think that the recommendations still stand, even though there may be some questions about how we go about it.
Sherry, do you have any comments?
You bet. Yeah, first of all, I want to thank my three colleagues here. I'm very determined for each of us to be able to have our input and our ideas and come to this board with recommendations that we felt were going down the right pathway for the right people, and also trying to give Mr. Lori his backstop to ensure that these reviews were going to be done, they were going to be looked at. Basically, we just formalized the process to be more effective and more efficient in these mass wasting prescriptions. And I think it's really timely also for the board to realize that we do have science coming before us before too awful long. And if that takes us into rulemaking, so be it. But I think we should wait until we have some really good scientific information behind us and not just emotion.
Before addressing the whole
thing. Yeah.
Dave, do you have any additional comments?
I'll add a few. Along the lines that Tom had mentioned. Well, first of all, I'm pretty new to the board here in this process, and I'm not. I learned a lot more about watershed analysis than I had known in the past. So that was really valuable. And what I had been concerned about was. What I learned was that there was a number of timber companies that had done watershed analysis, invested a lot of money doing the analysis, developing prescriptions that seemed to be working the way they were intended to work, and had been doing their 5-year reviews and all. So I thought, well, and we want to make sure that if there's prescriptions working, that they continue to be there for those timber companies that have them. But also, protecting public resources is also a very important issue. So the other timber companies and well, even DNR, whoever, the other companies that have prescriptions that haven't had those had their proper 5-year reviews to make sure that they're working the way they intended, they need to be brought up to speed. And so again, we felt like item number 5, we attempted to achieve that there. So I guess that was, we tried to, as Sherry said, avoid new rulemaking. I'm not sure that's entirely possible. So I guess that's these were consensus, so we still certainly support that, those consensus recommendations.
Okay. Questions from the board? Yes, Carolyn.
So I appreciate the work you do, and thank you for it. And I certainly agree that those folks who have HCPs doing the reviews, you know, keeping up with the science and so forth, that the last thing we'll do is get people off track who are trying to play by the rules that they agreed to. I guess the question in number five, though, I appreciate how you tried to construct the backstop, but why wouldn't you just, for those cases where a review hasn't been done, why wouldn't the default be the current rules until or if a review were done and prescriptions developed and everything? It just looks a little convoluted to me. And what was your thinking on that?
Part of it is that to get to there requires rulemaking. So we will have to go through a rulemaking process to get to that point. We can't change the rule as it exists right now just by us saying we want it to be done a different way. But we wanted to create the backstop, the first option of being the voluntary approach. And just to give you anecdotal information, I guess more than anything else, conversations with landowners that do have watershed analyses have indicated that many, if not all of them, are ready to accept the standard rules as an alternative to the prescriptions during a review process. This is not necessarily an item of great resistance. So again, this is a voluntary acceptance that then becomes the condition as part of the approval of that forest practice application and then becomes law for that specific application. But in the event that that didn't happen, and somebody says, you know, I'm going to stick with my prescription and the heck with you, it's certainly been my experience as a landowner that the DNR has the authority to take necessary actions to either stop or prevent damage to public resources. We're not advocating that we go down that road, but that is some of the backstop that Tom wanted, which is why it's sort of a three-step process of use the prescriptions if they're working. If it looks like they're not, see if the landowner will agree to a voluntary accept something different. And if that doesn't work, utilize your existing enforcement regulatory authority to achieve protection.
So how's that not rulemaking? If you have to, I understand the voluntary.
It's not rulemaking because it's part of the existing process. It's part of what is already allowed within the forest practices system by the forest practices forester utilizing existing authorities. But to simply say, for this board to say, or for the DNR just to implement, must use standard rules, would be rulemaking and would have to go through the adaptive management process.
So there's an important question here, and that is whether DNR has existing authority to step forward if they feel that there's an out-of-date analysis to step in and require something different. And Chuck, are you prepared to comment on that?
I'm not, and I'm not a lawyer. I can tell you there are several studying behind me, and if we brought them up here, they would give you different answers to that question. That's a part of what we still have to sort out. And when you finish your discussion and Darren talks with you about how we would move this forward, that's a part of what we have to sort out.
Darn, I was hoping for a simple answer.
I would love to give you one. It would have made this whole process a whole lot easier.
Other questions? I'm gonna go to non-committee members for a little bit.
I wanted to follow up.
Okay.
Karen asked a question of the committee, and so I wanted to add just my thoughts to that. And again, we felt like the language that we use the term condition here was that if a five-year review needed to be conducted, that if DNR felt there was a potential problem while that review was being conducted, they could condition any activities as they felt they would need to until the review was complete.
That's the question I still have. Asking them to do it voluntarily and they said, yes, let's do it. I have no problems with that. But it's that third step that is still a gray area for me.
But I've, unfortunately, Dave, I think this, Chuck would answer again that it's not clear that we have that authority. We're a little concerned, but we'll talk about that more later. Other questions from board members? Brad?
Yeah, I was looking for a little help understanding the scale of the problem. On one hand, I heard 31 needed to be looked at, but in earlier testimony, the numbers I heard were much larger.
The 31 was making an assumption. If you remember, there are 17 of these that are included in HCPs, and from the people who spoke to us who had those, and it's not all of them, it appears that those are the most likely to be adequate and to have had appropriate review. If that assumption's right, then that would take the number down to about 31, but it is an assumption. It's somewhere between 31 and 48.
My question was more to whether it's 31 or 48. Earlier testimony seemed to indicate that it was a much bigger problem. Somebody commented on that.
I think I can. The confusion may be in that there are 52 approved watershed analyses that encompass some 68 or 69 different watershed administrative units. So that may be where the higher number came from in previous discussion. Does that make sense?
I think so. I guess specifically I'm referring to the Conservation Caucus's letter for February 5th. And the high numbers in the first paragraph there on page 2. Looking to get some context for that versus...
Is that about the number of landslides?
Well, yeah, there's landslides and references to 64% in the watersheds, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can't comment on the number of landslides. We didn't look at specific landslides as part of this effort. Okay. We're simply looking at the approved analysis.
Can anybody make the comparison between 31 and references here? Anybody that can help me understand that?
Well, I threw out the 31, so I'll give it a shot as to how I got there. And again, it was just my own math from the slide that was shown. If we started out with 52 approved watershed analyses, and I think there was mentioned that there were four of them that didn't have mass wasting prescriptions, or one that was all three that do not, and one that was all non-specific.
Three that have 100% specific, and one that's 100% non-specific.
Okay. Right. Oh. Okay. So, and then there are 17 that are in HCPs. 17 correct. Watershed analyses that are in HCPs. I know that at least the ones that are in West Fork and in Plum Creek have had reviews of their utilization of those prescriptions as part of their HCP. So that removes some portion of that 17, but maybe not all.
That's correct. I won't say our records are completely up to date and accurate, but they indicate that we have about 10 to 11 okay. reviews that have been done. Not 10 to 11 watershed analyses necessarily. But West Fork has been clearly the most active.
Yeah, and I think they have 9, if I remember correctly.
Yes, right.
So if you take the 48, subtract at least 9, and then maybe a few more, it gets us down to the universe that we're talking about. So it's between 30 and 40 more than likely. And that's a number that is certainly something you contemplate getting done over a several year period of time, if it takes even that long.
Thank you.
You specifically mentioned the top of page 2 of the letter that you have from the Conservation Caucus, and you asked about those numbers. So I just reread that paragraph. The numbers that are in there are not attributed to a particular source. However, when Mr. Goldman testified in front of you as a part of public comment a few minutes ago, I believe those are the same numbers that he used, and I believe he said that they came from preliminary information that he thought was from the postmortem study. That gets to the last point in these recommendations, that that is one of the two studies that would be forthcoming.
Other questions? Anna?
Just a question for the committee, and thank you also for your hard work. Going to number 6, recommending that DNR establish this process and priority system to determine when their reviews would be necessary. Did you envision as part of that process DNR undertaking how effectiveness monitoring would be conducted as well, or was this just to, did you see that at, yeah, as part of it, or was this really a process to establish, I don't know, is that inherent in determining when a five-year review is necessary?
Well, I think the effectiveness of the prescriptions is part of the review. So it's not necessarily effectiveness monitoring in its broader sense, but it's certainly effectiveness of the prescription in achieving the protection of the public resource.
Yeah, not necessarily continuing to see if those are working.
That's really the subject of the senior studies.
Okay.
Dave? Yeah. A couple points. thank you for your work. Recommendations 6 and 7, most clearly to me, seem to be a deviation from the existing rules. And we're a rulemaking body, and I don't think we can recommend a process for changing when these reviews should happen or who can do them unless we do rulemaking. That's really our only authority is rulemaking. We can't interpret the rules. And so those two clearly to me call out a rulemaking process. The third point, I was there in 88 when we conceived of watershed analysis in the room. The first draft was in 90, and then 92 we started this. But the whole process was predicated on sort of site-specific or landscape-specific prescriptions that were built by a team using the manual, you know, the sideboards you gave it. And that we knew it was experimental, and adaptive management was a critical part of it, and adaptive management was the five-year reviews. The only way you could determine whether what you were doing in that watershed analysis had any value was to do these reviews. And so I'm really troubled by, you know, continuing to rely on prescriptions that haven't been tested in that manner, because that was a fundamental part of the process. And I think that the second question, the legal question about DNR's authority, is critical to try to do preventive prevention of harm rather than reactive. But the second question is, since the process hasn't been followed, the rule hasn't been followed with these five-year reviews, what is the status of the rule? Who's liable for having not followed through with what the law says we're supposed to be doing, the rules say we're supposed to be doing? And I think that's probably something the attorneys will want to talk about later, but that's a second fundamental question, because, you know, if DNR can go in and say, hey, we've got a problem here and we don't care if you have a watershed analysis, we need to do X, well, I think that's one path I think many of us are more comfortable with, but that leaves the landowners out. But if DNR cannot, and we're relying on these old prescriptions, then we have prescriptions that haven't really been tested and have been hanging out there without that fundamental review that was anticipated in watershed analysis and in the rule. So those are my comments.
Norm, can I respond to that, David? As far as the review, and I'm going a little bit from memory and not the exact words, but there were several things that could trigger a review. An event, landslide event, a damage to the resources kind of event. The landowner can trigger a review. The DNR can also ask for a review. But in most cases, those reviews have not been asked for, which is why they haven't happened. And with the exception of the HCPs, where they're tied into specific language within their continuation of the incident take permit, those reviews simply have not occurred, not necessarily out of design or lack of interest, but just because nobody's stepped up and said, we need to do the review. So we think the authority is there, that this does not present rulemaking per se. That authority is already within watershed analysis. But this just sets up, let's get on with it, and let's do it through a bit of a priority system so that those that maybe have indicated the most problems or the worst prescriptions, least effective prescriptions, may be triggered first, and those that have been effective or have maybe few operations upcoming may be triggered last. But that we could get on with doing those reviews, and there's nothing much to stop us.
So I'm going to ask the question again, Chuck. Is your interpretation of the current situation the same that Norm just enumerated? That it's really up to DNR to make the request, or who's responsible for the lack of the up-to-date review?
There is a phrase in the language that makes all of this problematic, and it's the fact that it spells out certain things that are supposed to occur, and then there's a comma, and the phrase "if necessary" appears. And that's why we have so many different opinions.
Dave put that in there.
No, I didn't know.
And it's good to know that.
I remember who did
put that in. But that is one of the things that's causing this to be, the phrase ambiguous has been used a lot around that. And I do not have an answer for you. I would like to ask you, I need to make a correction. I characterized what Mr. Goldman said when he spoke to you, and I characterized it correctly as to what he said, but he misspoke. The data that he was giving you, those numbers, and I believe they're the same numbers in the letter, did not come from the postmortem study. That data is not yet available to the public. Where that data actually came from was a set of flights that the DNR Geology and Earth Resources Division did after those last storms. And I thank Mr. Mendoza for that correction.
Right. Phil?
Board Member Summers, just want to mention to you that if you or other board members feel like you need advice, legal advice, there's a mechanism for you to ask for that. You can ask me. We would provide that advice in writing, not in an open public meeting. Does everybody understand that?
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions from board members?
Can I just one follow-up?
Dave.
In the qualifications of individuals to do the reviews, do we have people that are currently certified and qualified to do those reviews?
Not certified per the watershed analysis rule, but we have the qualified experts that are used in the CEPA process to prepare geotechnical reports.
Does the rule
that we would suggest meet the intent of a qualified expert under watershed analysis? We may have to do some briefing, some limited training of those folks about watershed analysis in particular, but we believe their background and experience is adequate. Per recommendation number 7.
I guess be interested if the rule has gives us that flexibility, but I can ask that. So.
Other questions? So, Darren, do you have any further recommendations or paths?
Well, I want to go back to something I think Board Member Summers pointed out, which was a good observation and something I wanted to remind you of. I believe all of these recommendations except 2 are to DNR. And as Board Member Summers pointed out, the board is a rulemaking body and does not direct DNR. So in effect, those recommendations are probably to the chair as the Commissioner of Public Lands. Now, should there be rulemaking involved in where 2 of these recommendations, then of course the board would get involved in that. But I wanted to just make sure that that was clear when that was brought up earlier.
Yeah.
Now, the action you could take here is simply to set, if you want to accept these recommendations and have us bring back a proposal for how we would implement them, is to either do that at the next meeting or set a special meeting to take up that single topic. And we could do that probably as early as late March.
So I think the conversation is pretty clear here, and I hope Darren's comments add to that, in the sense that it's a complicated topic. I think the committee has done a good job in a very difficult environment of trying to chart a path forward, in a sense to separate the wheat from the chaff, if I can be rather broad about it. And it's not at all clear what the appropriate path forward might be to implement the intent, I think, of these recommendations. So I think what Darren is suggesting is that if appropriate, that we give instructions to DNR staff to look carefully at these recommendations
to work with council and to chart a path forward in a fairly brief time, and that we then hold a special meeting, perhaps sometime in March, to develop a process and get started on implementing these recommendations. Because it's not, we have not had the time, quite frankly, since this report appeared, to really fully, thoughtfully figure out exactly what might be involved in the implementation. But I think it's really important what Mr. Summers has said, and that is the implementation that this board really undertakes is rulemaking. And rulemaking takes time. It's a sad fact. And so we want to make sure that we know exactly what we're doing, and I think it would be staff determination to be able to carry out those additional analysis and studies and then come back to us in a fairly short time horizon so that we can get on with this process.
That sounds very reasonable to me, and I like the idea of a special meeting in March, especially if rulemaking is necessary, because that's something we've got to move on as soon as possible.
And that's why we're making that suggestion, that to us was preferable from, or we think would be preferable from your perspective, to waiting until May.
Oh,
that,
absolutely.
Which, if we can do the special meeting and we do need rulemaking, hopefully we can do that in a couple of months.
So, just thinking out loud here, I think it would be appropriate for us to accept these recommendations, and that we refer the recommendations then to staff to come back to us at a special meeting in March as to how we can best implement these, either through rulemaking or whatever other process is necessary, given these recommendations.
That is exactly the request of this committee, was that we as a board would accept the recommendations and refer them to the department for implementation as would be necessary, whether that takes rulemaking or other action.
Do you want a motion to that effect?
That'd be entirely what?
We don't need it.
Don't necessarily need a motion, but you should try to schedule a special meeting if that's your desire.
So, what process would you like to use to establish a meeting time in March? It's going to be on a Tuesday, not on a Wednesday. Thursday, not on a Wednesday.
What's that?
We proposed dates.
Okay.
March 18th, 19th, or March 26th.
What day of the week?
Thursday and Friday. Friday.
And again, with this being a special meeting and a single topic, we can set this up to be done. Those of you who are here local will have a place here. If you want to do it by phone, we can do that to facilitate this being a little easier.
At the risk of stating the obvious, let's, if it's acceptable, let's try and do this online. I'm thinking that this may be a little difficult to try and do right now. We've done that in the past. I think we can do it yet this week, where staff will query you, and you can give your preferences back, and we'll pick an optimal date through that process instead of doing the messy approach. Is that acceptable? Okay, we'll do that.
The last thing I want to do, I want to thank the four board members who were a part of the committee. You guys did work hard, and you were dedicated to this. There was also quite a bit of staff time involved. Aaron and his course practice staff, the folks who came to the meetings. And in light of some of the comments that have been made, I think it's important to point out the committee worked completely within the public's eye on this. These were public meetings. They were publicized in the same way that the board meetings are. So this was done in a fully transparent manner.
Great. Okay, thank you for the report, and again, thank you to the committee for your hard work. And I think you can see we're going to move forward diligently on this and rapidly. Okay, with that, let's take a 10-minute break. We'll reconvene at 3:40.